KSDP, 8:30 a.m. in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay, KFPS, 88.1 FM in Falls Pass, and KKQA, 88.1 FM in Akutan, Alaska.
Welcome to the Bioneers, revolution from the heart of nature.
We were approached by Brazilian scientists who said, you know, we love Google Maps, we love Google Earth, but what we really need is to deal with the fact that we're losing 1 million acres a year of Amazon rainforest. It's happening typically illegally in parts of the forest where there's not good law enforcement on the ground. However, there's daily satellite imagery that is free, public domain, that we could build a virtual alerting system.
It's all alive. It's all connected. It's all intelligent. It's all relatives.
We stand at the threshold of a historic opportunity in the human experiment to reimagine how to live on Earth in ways that honor the web of life, each other, and future generations. It's a revolution from the heart of nature and the human heart. In this series, we celebrate social and scientific innovators with breakthrough solutions for restoring people and planet, creating a future environment of hope. In India, music, literature, and cultural mythology overflow with references to monsoon season and imagery of rain meeting scorched earth. The monsoon is so significant to the rhythm of life that a late arrival of rainfall or variations in its quantity can result in flooding or drought. More reliable forecasting could help farmers and communities to better prepare each year. Ancient legend has it that the first appearance of a small migratory bird called the pied cuckoo or rain bird signals the beginning of monsoon season. Scientists and bird watchers alike have tried to track the migratory patterns of the pied cuckoo to compare it with rainfall patterns. But the cuckoo travels thousands of miles, making it a challenge to gather data to prove whether or not the bird's association with the monsoon is myth or empirical fact. That is, until new digital tools emerge that enable amateur birdwatchers and professional scientists to work together across vast distances to report and track sightings of the pied cuckoo all over India and Africa. Guess what? They proved the legend is true. New democratized access to powerful analytical and mapping tools is transforming our understanding of the natural world, and with it, our ability to meaningfully conserve, protect, and restore our collective home, the biosphere. In this program, we explore the boundless possibilities of digital maps and platforms with Rebecca Moore, visionary founder of Google Earth Outreach and Google Engine. This is Radical Transparency, mapping the planet from the ground to the cloud. I'm Neil Harvey. I'll be your host. Welcome to The Bioneers, revolution from the heart of nature.
So we're going to talk about Earth's vital signs. Think about it. When you go to the doctor, you can get your heart function measured, your lungs, your brain, all these things. You can get all kinds of tests done. But what about the planet? What about the Amazon that produces the oxygen that we breathe, or all the river systems of the world that are like the bloodstream? Where can we all go and know how healthy are those critical systems of our Earth? It has been basically nowhere. So if there's ever been the moment to harness technology and service of planetary health, this is it, right?
Rebecca Moore is the creator of Google Earth Engine, and she's one of the driving forces behind some of the most inspiring and strategic uses of cutting-edge technology. As an engineer and computer scientist, she dreamed up and directs the Google Earth Outreach Program. The program has supported nonprofits, communities, and indigenous peoples around the world to apply state-of-the-art mapping tools to help solve some of our most urgent crises. However, it's not just breakthrough science that's changing the game. The real development is how it's enabling profound stories to be told in ways that compel and inspire action as never before. Rebecca Moore's dream is for Google Earth Engine to become a digital dashboard for planetary health. Rebecca Moore spoke at a Bioneers conference.
We launched a new version of Google Earth. We realize the heart of it is storytelling, tying the issues and the concerns and the dreams and the solutions and the challenges and all of that to the land. And we've invented this new digital magazine of the planet we call Voyager. If you take a look at Google Earth, it's on web, Android, and iOS. And every week we're updating it with stories. And as you can see, there's a bit of an environmental bent. Nature stories, stories about climate change. We're trying to educate the world about the world, things they need to know. Yeah. There's fun stuff in there. This is my current personal favorite Voyager story, is the brown bears of Katmai National Park. So we're putting live nature cams in here, like bird cams and so on, so you can see what's going on right now. You know, we want to bring the world alive, this digital, dynamic planet, this beautiful place that we live, have everybody understand and be able to celebrate it.
Scientists from institutions around the world are in fact measuring these exact planetary functions. Tools such as eddy flux towers, which allow precise measurements of carbon dioxide and oxygen, have proven the role of the Amazon rainforest as the lungs of the planet. But if facts and good science were all that were required to compel action, we wouldn't be in the predicament we're in today. Rebecca Moore is leading a groundbreaking effort to leverage technological innovation to provide a storytelling scaffold which can help turn planetary science into planetary action.
We were approached by Brazilian scientists who said, you know, we love Google Maps, we love Google Earth, but what we really need is to deal with the fact that we're losing 1 million acres a year of Amazon rainforest. It's happening typically illegally in parts of the forest where there's not good law enforcement on the ground. However, there's daily satellite imagery that is free, public domain, that we could build a virtual alerting system. We can use science to detect the change. We could alert people. But the problem is, it's like petabytes of data. Most people don't even know what that is. It's billions of megabytes of data. If you're going to try to manage all that satellite imagery, and if you try to then do the analysis, it takes weeks on a single computer. And they said, so we're stuck. It's so tempting. We could do it, but we need scale. So that's when Google Earth Engine was conceived, in the Brazilian Amazon, because we do have a few computers at Google. And, you know, they're running YouTube and Gmail and search and so on. Well, why not have them run an environmental analytical engine for the planet? Yeah. So that's Google Earth Engine, an environmental planetary scale engine to help us understand, map, measure, and monitor what's going on Earth.
This kind of data has been especially powerful for many indigenous communities around the world. In 2003, the chief of one of the four clans of the Pater Sarui tribe in the Amazon came across Google Earth in an internet cafe. Chief Almir Nariamoga Sarui looked at Sarui territory and realized there was a huge amount of illegal logging that he didn't know about. In partnership with Google Earth and Rebecca Moore, his tribe mapped every inch of its territory. Now, tribal members download images monthly from Global Forest Watch that they share with the authorities and with environmental and human rights groups. The Sarui tribe has successfully curbed illegal logging and mining on their land, and that's not all.
They became the first indigenous tribe to sell carbon offsets, and it's brought millions of dollars into the tribe, and they've applied it for reforestation projects. And I have visited them over a period now of almost 10 years. And when I first visited, it was somewhat sad because so much deforestation had happened. And they were planting these little saplings. And I was like, this is never going to amount to anything. I didn't understand how the Amazon works. Coming back like last year, they're huge, towering, laden with fruit and nuts. He was serving us. It was so amazing to see the recovery of the forest and animals coming back, and the Quilombola community. These are descendants of escaped slaves in Brazil, African in origin, And they have struggled, even though they've lived on this land for maybe hundreds of years, many generations, they don't have official land rights. And through the mapping tools, they have now sort of established a history of occupation and use of the land. And certain things with the maps gave the Brazilian government confidence to grant them permanent land tenure. So they now own this land that they've been trying to get for more than two decades.
Rebecca Moore sees that tools such as globalforestwatch.org are actually helping stop destruction in its tracks of both nature and communities.
It's a cat and mouse game. The people that are doing, in some cases, the illegal logging, they used to log during the dry season because that was more convenient for their trucks and so on. But now they know they can be seen from space. So they're logging during the rainy season. And they used to be able to get away with that, but now there's radar. And we bring all the radar data into Earth Engine, and this group, Instituto Socioambiental in Brazil, developed a radar-based algorithm, and they saw this line developing of change in the heart of the Amazon, not near any roads. They're like, is this a bug in what we built, or is there something really there? Finally, they sent a plane. Yes. It was an illegal mining operation. They got it shut down immediately, law enforcement, and so on and so on. So. What's also exciting is then the follow-on knowledge that can come. So 90% or so of the endangered species of the world are forest-dependent. So if you want to stop species extinction, just protect the forests, right? It's not complicated. This fantastic scientific study was done, and this is where we talk about mapping solutions, that determined if we just preserve the existing intact tiger habitat on the planet, not only can we stop loss of tigers, we could double the global tiger population by 2022. So it's a recipe for conservation. Yeah.
The famous primatologist Jane Goodall used Google Earth successfully in her fight to protect the Gombe National Park in Tanzania, home to the chimpanzees that she's worked with for decades.
And because it's a national park, there's no logging allowed. So that's fine. There's no deforestation. But exactly right at the border of that park with the outside land, suddenly all this deforestation is done. And the slopes are very steep there. And there was a large storm. And where the forest was on the slope, there was no landslide. And just right next to it, where the forest had been cut, there was terrible landslide, like 14 villagers were killed because their village was buried. And you could see all this in Google Earth, right? You could see the steepness of the land, and it just jumped out at you that it was probably a dumb idea that they had logged that steep slope, and that, yes, that is probably what led to there being a landslide there and not right next to it. And she brought that, you know, Google Earth, she showed that to the president of Tanzania and advocated for there being a new law to ban logging on steep slopes, and it got passed.
Around 20% of the seafood we eat is caught illegally or unsustainably in some way, yet our oceans make up a global commons that no nation controls on its own. What if a technical tool could monitor the high seas and spotlight operations that are breaking international law or using unsustainable fishing practices? Two nonprofits, Oceana and SkyTruth, worked closely with Rebecca and her team to build just such a tool, Global Fishing Watch.
And it's bringing in all the data on all these vessels who are beaming their position for maritime safety. But now it can be used to manage and understand how we can fish sustainably, because fisheries are collapsing, but it's well known that if we could just conserve and fish a little more intelligently, the oceans could be abundant for generations to come. So we just need to be smarter with this, yeah. You can see the tracks of individual vessels. You can determine using AI, are they trawling, are they longlining, are they just transiting? And again, you might say, oh, are we invading their privacy? Well, think about the balance between how the global commons of the ocean has been so systematically abused. So it seems a small concession that you would let your position be known in exchange for ensuring that we're fishing sustainably.
Seeing is believing. When decision makers and citizens can actually see these environmental crimes in progress, it can change the game. The island nation of Kiribati suspected that there was illegal fishing in an area that they were protecting, but it had no proof until Global Fishing Watch provided visual evidence of a vessel doing just that.
The government of Kiribati impounded the vessel, but the captain said, "You have no proof that we..." Yeah. Yes. This is critical for these small island nations. They don't have the U.S. Navy. They have maybe thousands of islands. How are they going to protect their waters? This is a way to virtually ensure that these protected areas are truly protected. They're not just paper parks. The fine, by the way, the captain said, we'd like to move to settlement discussion once the proof was given to them, resulted in a $2.2 million fine, which is 1% of the country's GDP. Indonesia, seafood is incredibly important for their diet. The Minister of Fisheries, Minister Susi, has now adopted Global Fishing Watch for her government's use. She is quite something, because there's a lot of illegal fishing in Indonesia's waters. If she knows a boat is illegal, she will warn the crew, they get off the boat, and then she blows it up. You do what you gotta do. All right, so there's also a very strong science aspect. All this data that we've produced, we're making available openly for scientists, economists, you know, ecologists to study and understand what are these patterns and how do they relate to slave trade or, you know, sustainable fishing and so on.
Global Fishing Watch has been phenomenally successful. It supported the creation of numerous monitoring and conservation projects that wouldn't have been possible even a decade earlier. It has also been deployed to monitor marine protected areas, and its use has spread to 189 countries. Can these digital mapping and visualization tools help us chart the course to a different future in a restored world? Scientists, citizen scientists, and global storytellers are only beginning to tap into the boundless potential of new cloud computing and digital mapping technologies. More when we return. This is Radical Transparency, mapping the planet from the ground to the cloud. You're listening to The Bioneers, revolution from the heart of nature. To see Rebecca Moore present Global Fishing Watch and other dynamic visual mapping tools in action, visit bioneers.org/mapping. You can also visit bioneers.org to let us know what you think about the program and to find out how to attend the National Bioneers Conference. To reach us by telephone, call 1-877-BIONEER. When digital mapping tools are well designed and used ethically, they bring together technology, data, and human networks to mobilize faster and more effective conservation and restoration of nature and of our human relationship to the biosphere. Along with satellite imagery, 3D terrain mapping provides another level of accuracy and context for groups to better inform their decision-making processes.
One of the fundamental things that I see with being able to have people look at this kind of data, not just on an abstract map, but actually on satellite imagery in the 3D terrain and have an immersive sense of reality and context about proposed plans. It engages understanding and compassion, and people get emotional, you know, looking at these things. But the example was for Global Fishing Watch, when the government of Mexico was working with globalfishingwatch.org, the NGO that we're supporting with technology, about creating this new marine protected area that is an incredible area for schooling hammerhead sharks and tuna. It's a very, very, very biodiverse part of the ocean. And the local fishing industry said, oh no, if you take that area off limits, you're just going to collapse our entire livelihood. When the Global Fishing Watch data was presented on the ocean, like here is actually where you do fish, and then here's this little tiny area that we are proposing to set aside as this protected area, and it's like less than 4% of where you fish, what could you say? There was nothing more to say. It was so obvious. And so that's what I love about these kind of maps is often I think the debates that are happening and the disagreements are because you don't even have a common understanding of the basic facts. And so people are talking past each other and they're debating things that are not even the real issue. And I believe that when you present a very rich context for, let's say, an environmental issue by looking at it on the map, on a digital thing like Google Earth, then you elevate the discussion. These are the facts. Now we can debate what we're going to do about it. You can have different opinions, but we are not going to debate what's reality because we have that.
Although Google Earth is one of the big players in digital mapping technologies, the field is growing. Numerous other organizations and platforms are democratizing access to transformational tools. For example, Indigenous youth in Canada and New Zealand are connecting with their elders in a new way with what they call direct-to-digital. They interview elders about their culture and land, such as where they hold ceremony, gather medicinal plants or wood for arrows. Then they locate these areas in 3D Google Earth and present the satellite imagery to the elders, creating a bridge between generations to carry on the lineage of ancient knowledge and culture. Cities are learning about their potential for reducing their carbon emissions and optimizing clean energy sources. 10,000 cities around the world have taken a climate action pledge, and now, using Google's digital tools, they have access to crucial and reliable baseline information to make decisions that are grounded in earthly realities.
We have amazing 3D data in Google Earth and Google Maps. If you fly into the cityscape of San Francisco or New York, you see these beautiful 3D buildings. Well, what if we could turn that into an understanding of the solar potential of every rooftop in the world? And that's what we've done with Project Sunroof. You can go there, you can enter your own address, you can see the solar potential for your house. But also, we've done it for all these cities. We're looking at London, right? So we know for every 10 centimeter square, for every 10 minute period of every day of the year, what is the solar potential, taking into account shading and everything else. So we have very precise information of the potential for cities, countries to go solar. We've packaged that up into a tool that we launched at the One Planet Summit and the Global Climate Action Summit. We called it the Environmental Insights Explorer. San Jose took that data, and they've become the first city to commit to being a gigawatt solar city. Because they knew they could be that ambitious because we showed them you could generate 3.4 gigawatts. So 1 gigawatt seems reasonable. We're giving them the data to increase their level of ambition.
Our modern, technologically mediated society increasingly makes us feel as if time is in fast forward. Nature operates on far longer and larger cycles, slow time. One of the more unique contributions that Rebecca Moore has been developing is called Earth Engine Time Lapse. This 32-year animation of the entire planet allows visitors to zoom in anywhere. You can travel to the place you were born and see how your community has changed over three decades. Moore says its creators analyzed 5 million satellite images containing 3 quadrillion pixels, ran it in parallel on 66,000 computers, and produced it in a few days. A single computer would have taken 300 years. Different species and planetary processes operate on vastly different time frames. A river's location today may be wholly different than its course centuries ago. If there's one constant in nature, it's change, and it's both fast and slow. To live well in real time, we need good real-time information and the long view. Again, Rebecca Moore.
We see the artificial palm islands built off the coast of Dubai suddenly sprouting, these artificial islands. You see a meandering river over three decades, and you see as it's meandering to the west, the city that it's meandering into is moving further to the west. It's fascinating. It makes you feel how alive the planet actually is. And I have this dream that as people take actions that are healing for the planet, it would light up on Google Earth. So like a school decides to put solar panels on their school, they would get a little green dot, you know, or whatever, and you would start to see some kind of summing of all these actions that are happening around the world and build a kind of a global community watch program for the planet and a global community sense of will and progress. We feel we can play a strong role in bringing radical transparency to the choices and decisions and things that are happening on Earth so that no one can kind of be unaware or ignorant or in denial. Ignorance is not bliss in this case. We all need to have our eyes wide open about what's going on and, you know, honestly give the most actionable information to all the people that have any role to play in making decisions or oversight on those decisions, like citizens, so that it's easier to do the right things.
Rebecca Moore, Radical Transparency, Mapping the Planet from the Ground to the Cloud. To explore more Bioneers radio programs, podcasts, and videos, visit bioneers.org. The Bioneers, Revolution from the Heart of Nature, is a production of Bioneers and Collective Heritage Institute. Executive producer, Kenny Ossabell. Written by Kenny Ossabell. Senior producer and station relations, Stephanie Welch. Host and consulting producer, Neil Harvey. Producer, Teo Grossman. Program engineer and music supervisor, Emily Harris. Our theme music is co-written by the Baka Forest People of Cameroon and Baka Beyond from the album East to West. All royalties from Baka compositions and performances go to the Baka Forest People through the charity Global Music Exchange. Additional music was made available by Mark Barrett at markbarrett.com. My name is Neil Harvey. Thank you for listening. This is program number 0418.
This program was made possible in part by Guayaki Yerba Mate, working with indigenous farmers in South America to grow shade-grown organic yerba mate to inspire us all to come to life. Learn more about Guayaki's products and regenerative mission at guayaki.com.
Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the program.
My late mother came from a musical family, the Carneys, and she had a beautiful singing voice. Her signature song was the haunting Bantry Bay, but she had a wide repertoire in Irish and English. She also directed the choir for the Irish language mass in St. Michael's Church in Dunlera. My late father, Joseph, on the other hand, well, let me tell you the story he often told us. When he entered St. Patrick's Teacher Training College in Dublin in 1942, he confessed to the music lecturer that he couldn't sing. "Everybody can sing," the lecturer told him. However, as my father told it, after hearing him sing, that lecturer came to admit that there is an exception to every rule. I always felt that Dad might have been embellishing the story a little bit. But then I came across two interesting documents among my father's papers. The first was the results of his final summer exams from 1944 in the beautiful Shanachlo, Principal Unadachish, Clachta Ervunia, Bail Scrudu Gaelga, Slaunt Oliacht, Liniacht, and so on, all with respectable results beside them. But then we come to Kjol, and in the space for his mark was written the word Thayer, or free, presumably denoting that he had managed to obtain an exemption in music. And then there was a typed letter from February 1945 from the president of the college, Jerome Toomey, who clearly thought highly of my father, and was reporting back to him on his endeavours to recommend him for a teaching position in City Quay. He got the following response from Father Thomas O'Donnell, the administrator of City Quay. I can see my way to overlooking the singing deficiency in Mr. O'Driscoll's case. We are fairly well provided in that department here. So clearly the reports of my father's musical shortcomings were not so exaggerated after all. In fact, I never ever heard my father sing. Not in the bath, not in the shower, not even humming along to a favourite song on the radio. I've been known to break into song myself about the house, but I was always led to believe by my sister, and later by my wife, that as far as my own singing voice is concerned, it's my tone-deaf father I take after, not my pitch-perfect mother. However, about 2 years ago, I was acting as the announcer on the PA system at the sports day for Sculler Conn, my children's primary school. The day starts with a parade around the field, led by a piper, followed by Auron the Vian, played by the same piper. As the piper struck up the anthem, I felt the crowd needed a bit of encouragement to get their rendition going properly, so I started singing into the microphone. Sheen ye fianna fall, a toffee owle gerin. My efforts didn't seem to cause any obvious distress to the assembled parents and children, and I even received one or two compliments which seemed perfectly sincere. And then, soon after the sports day, a member of the parents' committee approached me to sing the national anthem at that year's sixth class graduation ceremony. At the age of 51, I had received my first invitation to sing in public, and I lost no opportunity to gloat about this to my wife and sister. Meanwhile, the Irish language mass with the choir that my mother directed many years ago continues every Sunday under its present director, Pauline E. Argon. I attend and occasionally read the lessons. I sing along with some of the hymns too, but not as part of the choir, unlike my sister Breed. Until one Sunday last June, when the choir numbers were down to four singers, as many members were on holidays. But the numbers attending the mass were up due to the presence of a cruise ship in the harbour. Pauline told me I was needed in the choir to make up the numbers, and not wanting to let the side down in front of the visiting tourists, I obliged. Tentatively at first, and then with increasing confidence, I sang the hymns. Old hits, as it were, like Deus Meus ad Vime and Arian Downig, as well as Pauline's own beautiful compositions and arrangements. Afterwards, Pauline came over to me and my sister Breed and told me with great enthusiasm how wonderful I had been. You're the dream team, she told us. My sister looked at me sceptically. But my warm glow in Pauline's praise evaporated when she went on to say, You really do have a wonderful voice, Fáchnne, just like your father. I think, after all, that it may be time to retire from my short career in public singing.
Oh. I heard this story in segments from a woman I queued behind in the Radio Center canteen in my first few days as a trainee producer in Donnybrook 40 years ago. When she turned from the counter till, she had the most beautiful blue eyes. You could see to the bottom of their sadness, like the wavering sandbed of a Mediterranean anchorage, all turquoise and moist. "You have the most beautiful eyes," I said. I didn't mention the Mediterranean. Now, I was a student with stubble, and she was close to retirement, but she didn't denounce me to human resources. This was still, thank God, the 20th century. Instead, we changed and exchanged a few words, and the styrofoam cup of black coffee burned my palm briefly while she dunked and hoisted her tea bag. Next time we met in the same canteen, I was a probationer. She was thinking pensions. What, she asked, was I working on? Well, I had found a photocopied typescript of a short play by Thomas McDonagh, the revolutionary martyr of the 1916 Rising, and former head of my own Department of English in University College Dublin. Admittedly, it was terrible, still. But it's not about insurrection, I said, or about resurrection. It's about reincarnation. The woman with the beautiful blue eyes that emerged had been 20 years younger when the jubilee of the Easter Rising was celebrated at every statue in every square of the 26 counties. I was 10 at the time and remembered the two Spitfires flying low over O'Connell Street and the vanguard who brought me to a barracks when I got lost among smelly trench coats at Nelson's Pillar. Blue Eyes would have been safe and settled in her own workspace, a tall box room off a grand corridor in the Henry Street headquarters of Radio Éireann, tucked in like a squashed shirt tail behind the GPO. It was Cosc and Aherin breakfast, dinner and supper, she told me. That was right and proper. But I didn't mind being asked to do a My Fair Lady feature on the fly. The film was still running round the corner, and it just so happened that Stanley Holloway, who plays Eliza Doolittle's dad in the film, was staying at the Gresham. He's the dustman who sings, "Get me to the church on time." "I'm getting married in the morning," I sang. "Ding dong, the bells are going to chime," she said. So I looked up everything about him, all the other films he'd made that weren't famous, the old black and white ones that begin with a naked man banging a gong. I actually went round the corner to see My Fair Lady again. "I even read the play it's based on," she said, "George Bernard Shaw's Pygmalion, which is based in turn on a Greek myth about a person called Pygmalion, who turns into Professor Higgins in the play and into Rex Harrison, who can't actually sing a note in the musical." "Talk about reincarnation," I said. "When I met him, he was lovely," she told me. "Not at all the working man he was always cast as. Very dapper, very dignified. I had a dozen questions I was going to ask him, all typed out, and I let him see them before we started. It was smooth sailing. One take, no edits, in the can. He knew the business. He'd broadcast on the BBC during the Blitz, for God's sake. And then I walked him from the building and out the front door. Flags and bunting everywhere, and soldiers practicing their drill for the big day where the stand was being erected at the post office." "The story should be in the archives," I said. I'm sure it's in the Variety archives." She told me that the same Stanley Holloway had told her it was good to be back in Dublin. But that wasn't anywhere in the accordion folds of the station archives. He told her it was good to be back in Dublin 50 years later, half a hundred years after, almost to the week, almost to the Easter week of 1916 itself. That wasn't in the archives either. There was no mention on acetate or reel-to-reel of Holloway, the teenage subaltern in the Connacht Rangers who'd been pinned down under crossfire at a bridge over a river that might have been a canal in the ricochet of chippings and the whiff of hot horse dung. And off he strode, the natty dresser with the military bearing, the flower seller's father, the cold man comic, into a seething Sackville Street, all open-back buses, duffel-coated students on bicycles with mudguards, and the beehive hairstyle of girls pushing hooded prams towards Lemon's Pure Sweets confectionery next door to the Metropole. I like to imagine that the fair lady with the beautiful eyes watched him disappear. Her turquoise iris must have moistened in the glare and diesel of a midday Dublin pavement. Then a colleague on his way to the Tower Bar clapped her on the shoulder and congratulated her in Irish on her coup. You needed an easy interlude, a respite from the rising, during the mayhem of this Jubilee month.
A few more hours before they tie the knot.
There's drinks and girls all over London, and I've got to track them down in just a few more hours.
I'm getting married in the morning.
It's early on a chilly February morning, and I'm making my way through the streets of Paris. Not just strolling aimlessly and soaking up the atmosphere wherever the city happens to take me. Oh no, this time, walking purposefully and with a definite spring in my step, I am a woman on a mission. Because I'm back in Paris for one reason only, to step inside the risen from the ashes cathedral of Notre Dame. And I can't wait to see it. Haven't been able to wait, if truth be told, since the cathedral ceremoniously opened its doors once again last December. And now here I am, in early February, with my 10 a.m. entry ticket stored safely on my phone, striding across Place de la Bastille, turning into the busy thoroughfare of Rue Saint-Antoine, and then, a few minutes later, ducking down to my left along the little street close to the city's Holocaust Museum. Walking, 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 until I find myself face to face with the River Seine. I cross over the wide road that runs along the quays and step onto the Pont Louis-Philippe, the bridge that leads straight to the Île Saint-Louis, my favourite corner of Paris. Right beside the Île de la Cité, it lies in the shadow of Notre Dame itself. Despite my mounting excitement as I get closer to the cathedral, once on the bridge, I stop. For as I stand there, I can see it now, just over there to my right, my first glimpse of the majestic towers of Notre Dame. Notre Dame, Our Lady, a lady mourned across the world when the cathedral that had stood sentinel in Paris for 8 centuries went up in flames just before Easter 6 years ago. And now, here she is. Risen again. Despite my lack of religious belief, I've always loved Notre Dame, and just standing on the Pont Louis-Philippe for a few quiet minutes on this particular morning, it all comes flooding back. The history, the Gothic beauty, the power and the glory. And personal memories too, like walking around the cavernous church almost 30 years ago with my elderly parents, my mother taken aback by how dark the interior was, my father admiring the rib-vaulted ceiling and finding himself overcome by simply being in the presence of such history. It was within these very walls, after all, he reminded me that afternoon, that Napoleon Bonaparte had crowned himself emperor. And now, following the catastrophic fire of 2019, due to incredible donations and to the painstaking work and boundless expertise of some 2,000 artisans, Notre Dame is back. I take a last look at those twin towers and carry on across the Louis-Philippe Bridge. And from there, I walk to the front of the cathedral and join the short, pre-booked queue. 2 minutes later, and I'm walking through the last judgment entrance door. I'm in. Oh, my God. I smile to myself as I stand stock still, thinking instantly of my mother as I look around, gobsmacked, and take in the cathedral's now luminous interior. Well, Marion, I say to her in my head, there's nothing dark about it now. It is stunning. Shiny and light and airy, the former dark and grimy stonework now gleaming in all its cream-coloured radiance. I wander around among the other visitors and worshippers, feeling somewhat overwhelmed. Suspended chandeliers glitter as far as the eye can see. The magnificent stained glass windows refract the morning light. The vibrant colours of the meticulously restored side chapel murals jump out at me as I pass. The cobalt blues and yellows and corals in the little St. Louis chapel would take your breath away. Compare and contrast with those blacker-than-black, smoke-damaged murals photographed after the fire. Just standing there, staring at them now, it feels like, well, a miracle. I sit down for a moment among the prayerful as I feel the tears rise in my eyes. Gathering myself, up I get a few moments later, and on I go. And that's when I happen upon another side chapel, one that is dedicated, in French and in English, to the women and men who saved and raised Notre Dame de Paris. With separate dedications to donors and builders, there's one particularly poignant plaque. In memoriam, it says, of Jean-Louis Georgelin, 1948 to 2023. Jean-Louis Georgelin, the former French army general charged with overseeing the reconstruction of Notre Dame, who died while mountain hiking just a year before the cathedral opened its doors again. Such poignancy and loss in a place that now speaks only of renewal and hope. And as I walk away from Notre Dame, leaving that glorious, light-filled cathedral behind me, I can't stop thinking about Jean-Louis Georgelin. For there's another line on his memorial plaque that's still going around in my head. Là où il y a une volonté, il y a un chemin. Where there's a will, there's a way. If you never believed that old adage before, just look to Notre Dame this Easter and believe it now.
Je vous salue.
There's a picture of my mother striding down a street in 1938, impossibly elegant. She's wearing a tailored suit with a pencil slim skirt. A clutch bag is tucked under her arm, and topping it all is a jaunty hat. You can't beat a hat. It's all about the tilt of the hat, the tilt of the brim. If it's curled back to reveal the face, you can seem young and innocent. If it's dipping over one eye or low enough to shadow both eyes, you're mystery woman. Think Ava Gardner, Ingrid Bergman. My mother liked the bit of mystery. So do I. You can hide a lot behind a hat. I fell in love with hats when I was about 13. I had discovered in our dressing up trunk a boater hat like French schoolgirls wore. I fancied it. So I decided to wear it to Sunday Mass. As I came downstairs, my father spotted it and he burst out laughing. "Would you look at her in the old-fashioned hat?" he said. So the hat was thrown back in my room. But I was bitten by the bug. Hats were theatrical. To my cousin's wedding, I wore a Dick Turpin hat with a swathe of black chiffon trailing down behind. One of the aunts was scandalized. Black chiffon at a wedding, she sniffed. Oh yes, a hat gets you noticed. But for a hat that's really dramatic, go and look in the Patrick Pearse Museum in St. Enda's in Rathfarnham at a portrait by William Orpen of Beatrice Elvery. She was a daughter of the family who owned the sports shops, and she was a progressive artist and illustrator herself. She's painted wearing a black hat with a high crown and a great fan of blue and black feathers springing from it. All this laid on her mane of bright red hair. She looks like a very beautiful witch. She was also the model for the marble bust of Roisin Dubh in St. Stephen's Green, and her face was described by Patrick Pearse as an expression of the soul of Ireland. All these things she may have been, but by God, she was also a woman who could wear a hat. The difficulty for hat wearers these days is finding an occasion, the odd traditional wedding, or maybe the races. Years ago, we had Sunday morning church, where, weirdly, the women had to cover their heads and the men had to bear theirs. So all along the window ledges and the spare seats were rows and rows of men's hats. Up to 50 or 60 years ago, most men wore hats, and you can see it in any outdoor picture of political gatherings or funerals. Hats were big business for families like those of Fianna Fáil leader and Taoiseach Sean Lamass. His father and his grandfather were trained hatters. Indeed, Lamass himself was probably the most nattily dressed and hatted Irish politician of all time. Look him up. Spats and a hat. Mind you, the big danger with a hat is of ever letting it out of your hand. My favourite was a Borsellino. I had spotted it coming through the men's department in Galerie Lafayette in Paris. It was dark brown felt with a three-colour leather band. And when I tried it on, it was perfect. From every angle, it was perfect, except for the price. So sadly, I put it back. When I told my husband about it afterwards, he marched straight back in and bought it for me. I love that hat. I still wear it, but once I had to hand it into a cloakroom. "Would you put it up there on the high shelf?" I begged the attendant. When I came back to collect it, the hat couldn't be found. "They'd look for it," they said. As I pulled on my coat, I found something stuffed in the sleeve. There it was, all squashed up like a child's knitted beanie. "Ah, you found it," they said happily. I was speechless. I did my best, but it never recovered the distinctive dip of its brim. Lesson learned, keep your hat on. Wearing a hat takes attitude. It's not just about how you look, but about how you feel. The hat designer Philip Tracy knows all about that. He was given a President's Distinguished Service Award, a recognition of members of the Irish diaspora and Friends of Ireland who've done the state or its reputation some service. So among the awardees were people who'd set up departments of Irish literature, who ran theatres featuring Irish dramatists, who had helped Irish immigrants, or who had stood up for human rights. Philip Tracy says simply that he makes hats and that they make people feel better. At the reception afterwards in the Oris for him and his fellow awardees, Philip was surrounded by his many brothers, tall County Galway men, well made as oak trees, with this fine silver birch, graceful to his fingertips, in their midst. You couldn't but be struck by the family resemblances and the family pride in the man who's been described by Vogue magazine as one of the greatest milliners in the world. "Hats are about emotion," he says, "and I like hats that make the heart beat faster. Boom, boom." ¶¶
many, many crazy things that will keep me loving you. And with your permission, may I list a few.
Last November, browsing in our local pet store, I came across a box with an enchanting picture of a chicken on it. Not a brown barnyard hen like you'd find on an egg box. No, this was a splash of yellow, a saffron puffball of a chick with a cheeky stance and a pretty pink beak. The box contained an electric mini incubator. As I read the instructions on the back, I began to feel a glow of excitement. I bought the box and drove home with the promise of spring perched on the passenger seat. We already keep hens, but by last November our flock was reduced to just two. Rory, our gentlemanly if vociferous light Sussex rooster, and a large white hen called Pecker. Pecker, aptly named, has an unerring eye, a razor-sharp beak and a taste for human flesh. So feeding time was a nightmare. But her eggs are delicious, with a golden yolk, and she laid daily regardless of the season. I decided we were on to a winner here. If we could hatch out four eggs with some of Rory's gentle temperament coupled with Pecker's reliability, we would have the perfect family flock. As I closely studied the instructions in the kitchen, counting out the weeks, I realised our potential flock should be just at point of lay for Easter Sunday. I visualised a brimming bowl of boiled eggs gracing the Paschal breakfast table. After much debate, we set up the clear plastic incubator in our children's old playroom. Our only responsibilities were to top up the water levels inside the incubator and to turn each egg daily. We performed these duties diligently, with painstaking precision. 3 weeks later, I arrived home to hear a faint tapping sound. The following morning, a little beak had poked its way through one of the shells. At lunchtime, a tiny damp chick was staggering round inside, and by nightfall, she was all I had hoped for, a fluffy saffron puffball with a cheeky stance. 3 long days later, we had given up waiting for the others to hatch. "Gluggers," pronounced my mother. We regretfully unplugged the incubator. But Tucker, as she was now known, was no glugger. Vigorous and seemingly highly intelligent, she was eating and drinking successfully in jig time. And when she was not eating, she was chirping. Within days, she began to sprout white pin feathers. Her legs grew longer and a little scaly. But as the weeks passed and she grew tall and ungainly, an unmistakable blast of barnyard odour greeted us every time we opened the playroom door. Soon the smell was pervading the whole house. "You're going to have to be brave," I told Tucker, as I lugged the little coop out to the shed, which she took in her stride. Christmas was thankfully mild. Neither the heavy snowfall of January nor Stormy Owen ruffled her now luxuriant milk-white feathers. And still she grew and became even more vocal, and sometimes I would look at her and wonder, what if she is a he? By the end of March, Tucker was the size of a small swan, docile in temperament. But why wasn't she laying any eggs? We were already well into Lent, Easter Sunday fast approaching. As we fed her one evening, I confessed my fears to my husband. "Maybe she's a chicken for the pot," he suggested gently. Tucker gave him a long look with her intelligent eyes and then marched back into the safety of the coop. The